Chapter 2. The Reign of Fear. Quote, "If I had time and anything like your ability to study war, I think I should concentrate almost entirely on the actualities of war. The effects of tiredness, hunger, fear, lack of sleep, weather. The principles of strategy and tactics and the logistics of war are really absurdly simple. It is the actualities that make war so complicated and so difficult, and are usually so neglected by historians." Field Marshal Lord Wavell, in a letter to Liddell Hart. What goes on in the mind of a soldier in combat? What are the emotional reactions and underlying processes that cause the vast majority of those who survive sustained combat to ultimately slip into insanity? Let us use a model as a framework of the understanding and study of psychiatric casualty causation. A metaphorical model representing and integrating the factors of fear, exhaustion, guilt and horror, hate, fortitude, and killing. Each of these factors will be examined and then integrated into the overall model to present a detailed understanding of the combat soldier's psychological and physiological state. The first of these factors is fear. Research and the Reign of Fear. A variety of past investigators came up with an overtly simplistic yet widely accepted explanation for psychiatric casualties when they declared that the cause of most trauma in war is the fear of death and injury. In 1946, Appel and Beebe held that the key to understanding the psychiatric problems of combat soldiers was the simple fact that the danger of being killed or maimed imposed a strain so great that it caused men to break down. And Watson, a London Times journalist, who made a multi-year study of the application of psychology and psychiatry to war, concludes in his book, War on the Mind, that combat stress, with its real fear of death, is quite different from other kinds of stress. But clinical studies that tried to demonstrate that fear of death and injury are responsible for psychiatric casualties have been consistently unsuccessful. An example of such a study is Mitchell Birkin's 1958 research into the nature of psychiatric breakdown in combat. Birkin began with a concern for the role played by fear, that is, by a concern about possible death or injury in the response to adverse environments. In one of his experiments, soldiers on board a military transport aircraft were told that their pilot would soon be forced to crash land the plane. The men put through the controversial, and by today's standards, unethical, fear-invoking situations in these human resources research office tests were then given long psychiatric interviews before and after, and again weeks later to see whether there were any hidden effects. None were found. The Israeli military psychologist Ben Shalit asked Israeli soldiers immediately after combat what most frightened them. The answer that he expected was loss of life or injury and abandonment in the field. He was therefore surprised to discover the low emphasis on fear of bodily harm and death, and the great emphasis on letting others down. Shalit conducted a similar survey of Swedish peacekeeping forces who had not had combat experience. In this instance, he received the expected answer of death and injury as the most frightening factor in battle. His conclusion was that combat experience decreases fear of death or injury. Both the Birkin and Shalit studies indicate that fear of death and injury is not the primary cause of psychiatric casualties on the battlefield. Indeed, Shalit found that even in the face of a society and culture that tells the soldier that selfish fear of death and injury should be their primary concern, it is instead the fear of not being able to meet the terrible obligations of combat that weighs most heavily on the minds of combat soldiers. One of the reasons that fear may have been generally accepted as a major explanation for combat stress is that it has become socially acceptable. How many times have we heard in movies and on television that only fools are not afraid? Such acceptance of fear is a part of modern culture, but we still tend to avoid any examination of what kind of fear. During World War II, the U.S. Army intentionally built a permissive attitude toward fear. And Stouffer's landmark World War II studies show that men who exhibited controlled fear were not generally poorly regarded by their peers. During World War II, In a widely distributed pamphlet entitled Army Life, the U.S. Army told its soldiers, "You'll be scared." Sure, you'll be scared. Before you go into battle, you'll be frightened at the uncertainty, at the thought of being killed. A statistician would call that biasing the sample. Research about fear has been that of blind men groping at the elephant. One grasps what he thinks is a tree, another finds a wall, and still another discovers a snake. All have a piece of the puzzle, a piece of the truth, but none is completely correct. There is within us the need to say what is socially acceptable, and like blind men groping at some vast beast, we tend to report that aspect of its anatomy that we already expect to find, and we reject those manifestations with which we feel uncomfortable. The supplied, accepted, comfortable name for this beast is fear. And few people are comfortable when dealing with such powerful alternative explanations as guilt. Fear is a specific yet brief and fleeting emotion that lies within the individual. But guilt is often long-term and can belong to the society as a whole. When we are faced with hard questions and the difficult task of introspection, it is very easy to avoid the truth and give the socially acceptable answers that war literature, Hollywood films, and scientific literature tells us we should give. Fear's place in the soldier's dilemma. Fear of death and injury is not the only or even the major cause of psychiatric casualties in combat. That is not to say that there is not some wisdom in this common understanding of battle, but the whole truth is far more complex and horrible. Nor should we claim that the carnage and death of battle are not horrible, and that the fear of violent death and injury is not a traumatic thing. These factors by themselves, however, are not sufficient to cause the mass exodus of psychiatric casualties found on the modern battlefield. There are deeper underlying causes for the psychiatric casualties suffered by soldiers in combat. Resistance to overt aggressive confrontation, in addition to the fear of death and injury, is responsible for much of the trauma and stress on the battlefield. Thus, the reign of fear is represented as only one contributing factor in the soldier's dilemma. Fear, combined with exhaustion, hate, horror, and the irreconcilable task of balancing these with the need to kill, eventually drives the soldier so deeply into a mire of guilt and horror that he tips over the brink into that region we call insanity. Indeed, fear may be one of the least important of these factors. Ending the reign of fear. Non-killers are frequently exposed to the same brutal conditions as killers, conditions that cause fear, but they do not become psychiatric casualties. In most circumstances in which non-killers are faced with the threat of death and injury and war, the instances of psychiatric casualties are notably absent. These circumstances include civilian victims of strategic bombing attacks, civilians and prisoners of war under artillery fire and bombings, sailors on board ships during combat, soldiers on reconnaissance missions behind enemy lines, medical personnel, and officers in combat. Fear and civilian victims of bombing attacks. The Italian infantry officer, Giulio Due, became the world's first recognized air power theoretician with the publication of his book, Command of the Air, in 1921. Due declared, "The disintegration of nations, which in the last war was brought about by attrition, will be accomplished directly by aerial forces." Prior to World War II, psychologists and military theoreticians such as Due predicted that mass bombings of cities would create the same degree of psychological trauma seen on the battlefield in World War I. During World War I, the probability of a soldier becoming a psychiatric casualty was greater than that of his being killed by enemy fire. Because of this, authorities envisioned vast numbers of gibbering lunatics being driven from their cities by a rain of bombs. Among civilians, the impact was projected to be even worse than that seen in combat. When the horror of war touched women, children, and the elderly, rather than trained and carefully selected soldiers, the psychological impact was sure to be too great, and even more civilians and soldiers were expected to snap. This theory, established by Due and later echoed by many other authorities, played a key role in establishing the foundation for the German attempt to bomb Britain into submission at the beginning of World War II, and the subsequent Allied attempts to do the same to Germany. This strategic bombing of population centers was motivated by quite reasonable expectations of mass psychiatric casualties resulting from the strategic bombing of civilian populations. But they were wrong. The carnage and destruction and the fear of death and injury caused by the months of continuous blitz in England during World War II were as bad as anything faced by any frontline soldier. Relatives and friends were mutilated and killed. But in a strange sort of way, that was not the worst of it. These civilians suffered one indignity that most soldiers need never face. In 1942, Lord Charwell wrote, "Investigation seems to show that having one's house demolished is most damaging to morale. People seem to mind it more than having their friends or even relatives killed." For the Germans, it was worse. The might of the vast British Empire was brought to bear on the German population via Britain's nighttime area bombing. At the same time, the United States devoted its efforts to precision daylight bombing. Day and night, for months, even years, the German people suffered horribly. During the months of firebombings and carpet bombings, the German population experienced the distilled essence of the death and injury suffered in combat. They endured fear and horror on a magnitude such as few will ever live to see. This reign of fear and horror unleashed among civilians is exactly what most experts hold responsible for the tremendous percentage of psychiatric casualties suffered by soldiers in battle. And yet, incredibly, the incidence of psychiatric casualties among these individuals was very similar to that of peacetime. There were no incidents of mass psychiatric casualties. The RAND Corporation study of the psychological impact of air raids, published in 1949, found that there was only a very slight increase in the more or less long-term psychological disorders as compared with peacetime rates. And those that did appear seemed to occur primarily among already predisposed persons. Indeed, bombing seemed to have served primarily to harden the hearts and empower the killing ability of the nations that endured it. When faced with the failure of their predictions, post-war psychologists and psychiatrists scrambled to find a reason for the obstinate failure of the populations of Germany and England to become mass psychiatric casualties in response to strategic bombing. They finally used the theory of gain through illness as a model to explain what had occurred. This held that these individuals failed to become ill because they simply had nothing to gain by doing so. The theory of gain through illness, however, fails for two reasons. Soldiers in combat will become psychiatric casualties even when they have nothing to gain by doing so, such is the nature of insanity. And second, these individuals did have much to gain by letting slip the bonds of reality and escaping into the countryside, or better yet, escaping to the psychiatric clinics that were usually located far from the targets of strategic bombing. Fear and prisoners of war as artillery and bombing victims. Gabriel notes that studies from both the First and Second World Wars show that prisoners of war did not suffer psychiatric reactions when they were subjected to artillery attack or aerial bombardment, but their guards did. Here we see a situation in which non-combatants, prisoners, were not traumatized by death and destruction, while the combatants, guards, with them, were. This theory of gain through illness has been applied to explain this disparity. That is, the guards could gain by becoming psychiatric casualties and departing to the nearest psychiatric clearing station, while the prisoners had nothing to gain and nowhere to go. So they elected not to become psychiatric casualties. But this theory does not bear up under careful scrutiny. Soldiers who are surrounded and without cover will flee from battle, even when they have nothing to gain by doing so. An excellent example of this can be seen in one of Custer's cavalry units, which was cut off and surrounded by the Indians for 2 days before being rescued. Yes, some of Custer's 7th Cavalry, at a different location under the command of Major Reno, did survive Little Bighorn. Only the ones with Custer were all killed. According to Gabriel, many of these soldiers, pretending to be ill or wounded, left their defensive positions for the medical station, even though it offered no protection. Indeed, the medical station was exposed to hostile fire and was very possibly less safe than positions on the perimeter. This example makes an important point about gain through illness. Combatants will try to get out of the battle, a situation where they are required to kill, even when it puts them at risk. Gabriel discards the gain-through-illness explanation in the case of prisoners of war, POWs, and guards receiving artillery fire or bombardment. He comes much closer to a more plausible explanation when he states that the prisoners had shifted responsibility for their survival to the guards. The prisoners had indeed relinquished responsibility to their guards, responsibility for survival, and responsibility for killing. The prisoners were unarmed, impotent, and strangely at peace with their lot in life. They had no personal capacity or responsibility to kill, and they had no reason to believe that the incoming artillery or bombs were a personal matter. The guards, on the other hand, took the matter as a personal affront. They still had a capacity and a responsibility to fight, and they were faced with the irrefutable evidence that someone was intent on killing them, and that they had a responsibility to do likewise. The psychiatric casualties among the guards, as among most other soldiers in the same circumstances, represented an accepted method of escape from the unbearable responsibility inherent in their role as soldiers. Fear and sailors in naval combat. For thousands of years, naval battles involved missile combat, bow and arrows, ballista, cannons, and so on, at extremely close range, followed by grappling, boarding, and vicious life-or-death, close-in battle, with no way to escape. The history of such naval warfare, like that of ground combat, provides many examples of psychiatric casualties resulting from this kind of combat. In its emotional demands, naval warfare was very much like its land-based equivalent. But in the 20th and 21st centuries, psychiatric casualties during naval warfare have been nearly non-existent. The great military physician, Lord Moran, noted the remarkable absence of psychiatric illness among the men he administered to aboard ships in World War II. Discussing his experience in two ships, he said one was sunk after surviving more than 200 raids in the whole of the First Libya campaign. The other was in four major actions in addition to many raids at sea and in harbor, and twice sustained actual damage. Yet the incidents of psychiatric casualties were almost non-existent. There were more than 500 men in the two ships, and of these, only two came to me about their nerves. After World War II, the fields of psychiatry and psychology attempted to find out why. And again, they suggested gain through illness. The sailor obviously had nothing to gain by becoming a psychiatric casualty, and therefore did not elect to do so. The idea that modern sailors had nothing to gain through becoming a psychiatric casualty is simply absurd. The sick bay of a warship is traditionally placed in the safest and most secure heart of the ship. A sailor standing in the open, firing a gun deck at an aircraft that is attacking his ship, has much to gain by making for the relative safety of sick bay. And even if his psychiatric symptoms can't get him completely away from the battle, they can most assuredly get him away from future ones. So why don't these sailors suffer from the same psychiatric ailments that their brothers on land do? Modern sailors suffer and burn and die just as horribly as their land-bound equivalent. Death and destruction fall all about them, yet they do not crack. Why? The answer is that most of them don't have to kill anyone directly, and no one is trying to specifically, personally kill them. Dyer observes that there has never been a similar resistance to killing among artillerymen or bomber crews or naval personnel. Partly, he says, this is due to the same pressure that keeps machine gun crews firing. But even more important is the intervention of distance and machinery between them and the enemy. They can simply pretend they are not killing human beings. Instead of killing people up close and personal, modern navies kill ships and airplanes. Of course there are people on these ships and airplanes, but psychological and mechanical distances protect the modern sailor. World War I and World War II ships often fired their weapons at enemy ships that could not be seen with the naked eye, and the aircraft they fired at were seldom more than specks in the sky. Intellectually, these naval warriors understood that they were killing humans just like themselves, and that someone wanted to kill them, but emotionally they could deny it. A similar phenomenon has occurred in aerial combat. As previously noted, World War I and World War II pilots, in relatively slow-moving aircraft, could see enemy pilots, and thus large numbers of them failed to fight aggressively. Modern pilots, fighting an enemy seen only on a radar scope, had no such problems. fear and patrols behind enemy lines. Another circumstance that is free of the usual psychiatric casualties associated with the battlefield involves patrols behind enemy lines. Although highly dangerous, such patrols are, by their very nature, a different kind of combat. And in World War I, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, they have had some common characteristics. As an infantry company commander and an Army Ranger, I've been trained by the U.S. Army to plan and conduct such patrols and have done so in training on many occasions. The majority of patrols are usually reconnaissance patrols. On a recon patrol, a small, lightly armed body of men is sent into enemy territory with specific orders not to engage the enemy. Their mission is to spy on the enemy, and if a recon patrol runs into an enemy force, it will immediately break contact with the enemy. The essence of a recon patrol is not to be found or seen, and there is not enough firepower with such a patrol to support any kind of offensive operation. Thus, although recon patrols are dangerous, and the information produced may result in many enemy soldiers being killed, the mission itself is a very benign operation. It is an operation completely free of any obligation or intention to directly confront or kill the enemy. Sometimes there is a requirement to capture a prisoner, but even this is a relatively limited engagement with the enemy. What could be psychologically less traumatic than being ordered to run from enemy aggression? If a patrol is not a recon patrol, it is usually on an ambush or a raid, in which a select group of men will attack the enemy at a planned point. Just as in a recon patrol, a combat patrol will immediately break contact with the enemy if it is spotted while moving to or from its objective. The killing actions of a raid or ambush are focused on one particular spot for one brief period of time. At all other times, the patrol, which depends on surprise for success, will run from the enemy. A raid or ambush patrol is carefully and thoroughly planned and rehearsed prior to leaving friendly lines, and the time in which killing takes place will be extremely brief and very much like that practiced in rehearsal. And, if conducted properly, the enemy will be caught by surprise and will have very little chance to fight back. The psychologically protective power of 1. Hitting a precise known objective, 2. Conducting such exact rehearsals and visualizations prior to combat, a form of conditioning, and 3. Attacking an enemy who is caught by surprise and will hopefully have little chance to fight back is tremendous. Thus, by their very nature, such combat patrols involve far less random killing and are therefore less conducive to psychiatric casualties. An additional factor to consider here is, as Dyer points out, that the extremely rare natural soldiers who are most capable of killing, those identified by Swank and Marchand as the 2% predisposed towards aggressive psychopathic tendencies, can be found mostly congregating in the commando-type special forces units. And it is just such units as these that are usually given the mission of conducting combat patrols behind enemy lines. Here, too, gain through illness has been used to explain the absence of psychiatric casualties during patrols behind enemy lines. And again, it is demonstrably wrong. Aside from the fact that men in combat go mad regardless of whether or not it will do them any good, such soldiers have much to gain by becoming psychiatric casualties. Patrols behind enemy lines are extraordinarily dangerous, and only one or two casualties, psychiatric or otherwise, en route, can result in aborting the mission completely. Even if the mission is not aborted, the wounded and incapacitated can be spared much of the danger involved in a patrol by remaining at a secure location where rucksacks, rations, and equipment are kept under the guard of a few men while the mission is completed. Above all else, indications of psychiatric stress by a soldier on patrol would ensure that the soldier would not go on subsequent missions. Soldiers on patrols behind enemy lines, like civilians suffering from strategic bombing, prisoners of war receiving artillery or bombs, and sailors in modern naval combat, generally do not suffer psychiatric stress because, for the most part, the element that is most responsible for causing combat stress is not present. They are not obligated to engage in face-to-face aggressive activities against the enemy. Even though these missions are highly dangerous, danger and the fear of death and injury are quite obviously not the predominant cause of psychiatric casualties in battle. Fear among medical personnel. They take not their courage from anger. Quote, in a vision of the night I saw them, in the battles of the night, mid the roar and the reeling shadows of blood, they were moving like light. With scrutiny calm, with fingers patient as swift, they bind up the hurts and the pain-ridden bodies uplift. But they take not their courage from anger that blinds the hot being. They take not their pity from weakness, tender yet seeing. They endure to have eyes of the watcher in hell and not swerve. For an hour from the faith that they follow, the light that they serve. Man true to man to his kindness that overflows all, to his spirit erect in the thunder when all his forts fall. This light in the tiger mad welter, they serve and they save. What song shall be worthy to sing them, braver than the brave? Lawrence Binyon, World War I veteran, The Healers. There is a significant body of evidence that indicates that non-killing military personnel on the battlefield suffer fewer psychiatric casualties than those whose job it is to kill. Medical personnel in combat have traditionally been bulwarks of dependability and stability. Ward Moran, writing about his military experiences in Anatomy of Courage, is one of many such non-killers who have recorded that they have never experienced the physical symptoms of fear. He experienced great emotional trauma, and he felt that certifying his unit as fit, which was his responsibility, was like signing the death warrant of 200 men, and I might be wrong. He concludes by saying that, even now, after 20 years, my conscience is troubled. Was it right that I should hold such men to the trenches? And if they were killed, were they or I to blame? Yet despite all of his experiences, he marvels at his own ability to stick for so very long when the soldiers around him broke beneath the psychological burdens of combat. In Moran's case, he felt that his lack of psychiatric symptoms during his long years of continuous combat in the trenches of World War I was because, as a medical officer, looking after the wounded gave him something to do. This may be true, but perhaps a large part of the answer is that he simply was not obliged to kill. The medic takes not his courage from anger. He runs the same or greater risks of death and injury, but he or she is given over on the battlefield, not to Thanatos and anger, but to kindness and Eros. And when it comes to the psychological well-being of its avatar, Thanatos is a far harsher master. And whereas one World War I veteran poet understood the nature of Eros on the battlefield and communicated it to us in his poem, The Healers, another understood and spoke of the nature of Thanatos on the painful field. Efficient, thorough, strong, and brave, his vision is to kill. Force is the hearthstone of his might, the pole star of his will. His forges glow malevolent, their minions never tire, to deck the goddess of his lust, whose twins are blood and fire. Robert Grant, World War I veteran, The Superman. The psychological distinction between being a killer or a helper on the battlefield was clearly made by one remarkable veteran I interviewed. He had served as a sergeant in the 101st Airborne Division at Bastogne, was a veteran of Foreign Wars post commander, and a highly respected member of his community. He seemed to be deeply touched by his killing experiences, and after World War II, he served in Korea and Vietnam as a medic on a U.S. Air Force air rescue helicopter. His harrowing adventures, rescuing and giving medical aid to downed pilots, he quite freely admitted, was a relief from, and a very powerful personal penance for, his relatively brief experience as a killer. Here, the one-time killer became the archetypal medic, ministering to the wounded soldiers and carrying them off on his back. Fear among officers. Very similar to the psychologically protected position of medics is the position of officers. Officers direct the killing but very seldom participate in it. They are buffered from the guilt of killing by the simple fact that they order it, and others carry it out. With the possible exception of rare self-defense situations, most officers in combat never fire a shot at the enemy. Indeed, it is a generally accepted tenet of modern warfare that if an officer is shooting at the enemy, he is not doing his job. And even though line officer casualties in most wars are consistently much higher than those of their men, in World War I, 27% of the British officers who served in the Western Front were killed, compared with 12% of the men. Their psychiatric casualties were usually significantly lower. In World War I, the probability of a British officer becoming a psychiatric casualty was half that of his men. Many observers feel that the lower incidence of psychiatric casualties among officers is due to their greater sense of responsibility, or the fact that they are highly visible, with greater social stigma associated with breakdown. Undoubtedly, the officer has a greater understanding than his men of what is going on, and his place and importance in it. And officers get more recognition and psychological support from military institutions, such as uniforms, awards, and decorations. These factors are probably all part of the equation, but the officer also has a far smaller burden of individual responsibility for killing on the battlefield. The key difference is that he doesn't have to do it personally. A fresh look at the Reign of Fear. It would appear that, at least in the realm of psychiatric casualty causation, fear does not reign supreme on the battlefield. The effect of fear should never be underestimated, but it is clearly not the only or even the major factor responsible for psychiatric casualties on the battlefield. The deaths, destruction, and fear experienced by those who survived months of bombing in England and Germany did not produce anywhere near the psychological breakdown suffered by soldiers in combat. The RAND Corporation studies outlined earlier make it clear that just as the distance involved helped the pilots and bombardiers to partially deny that they were personally killing thousands of innocent civilians, so too did the circumstances and distances involved buffer civilian and POW bombing victims, sailors, and patrols behind enemy lines from the wind of hate, which we will examine shortly, and permit them to successfully deny that anyone was personally trying to kill them. They simply didn't take it personally. Indeed, one might think that the civilians and the POW's inability to fight back would be a source of stress. But just the opposite appears to be true. Most bomber crews and artillery crews would eventually sustain psychiatric casualties, while the non-combatants they attacked generally did not. During World War II, bomber crews usually had the highest casualty rates of any combatants among the Allied forces. In the British Bomber Command, out of every 100 men, only 24 survived. Such figures, faced day after day without respite, appear to have been sufficient to result in the tremendous psychiatric casualty rates suffered by these crews. This fear was intermingled with a comparatively small quantity of horror and some burden of responsibility. One Vietnam-era bomber pilot claimed it was the killing of civilians, even at a distance, that eventually drove him to drink and troubled him the most in subsequent years. But fear may have been the predominant psychological enemy in this particular circumstance. The point is that fear is only one of many factors, and it seldom, if ever, is the sole cause of psychiatric casualties. The magnitude of the exhaustion and the horror suffered by combat veterans and victims of strategic bombing is generally comparable. The stress factors that soldiers experienced and bombing victims did not were the two-edged responsibilities of one being expected to kill, the irreconcilable balance of to kill and not to kill, and two, the stress of looking their potential killers in the face, the wind of hate.